Tonight we're going to be looking at a series of topics that, except for one maybe, really has only a few verses. And so we're going to start here, as you can see, on the omniscience of God, which is the all-knowing nature of God, His seeing and understanding all things. Just a few verses here, but starting in chapter 15 and at verse 11, Sheol and Abaddon lie open is supplied, not actually in the original text, it actually just says Sheol and Abaddon before the Lord. How much more the hearts of men. So Sheol and Abaddon is essentially two different ways of saying the same thing, that those things which have perished or been destroyed or have died, have been dissolved in any manner, you know, find their way, whether human or otherwise, into a state or condition of death / destruction. Ultimately, what the passage is saying is that if God sees into these places, He knows even where you are and what you are and how you are when you have been reduced back to ashes and dust, you know, then He certainly knows your heart as well. Sheol and Abaddon are before the Lord. How much more the hearts of men? God knows all things. He knows what you're thinking, what your character truly is. He sees into the depths of your heart the same way that He sees into the depths of the universe or outer space or into the spiritual realm, into death itself. And so it's a sobering thought. It's that all-seeing eye that we sometimes sing. The song has the same title. If you go to chapter 16, next chapter, and verse 2, all the ways of man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord, but the Lord weighs the motives. Have you ever met somebody who very consciously is saying, I'm doing wrong, I know I'm doing wrong, I think I am very foolish, I really believe that I've never added anything up correctly, you know, and so, and my every thought, my every deed, my every word, you know, is a mistake. You don't meet many people like that. Now, on the whole, people pretty well make the decisions that they think are right. And so whatever they do, there's a rationale behind it, there's logic behind it, there's a reason, you know, there's some sort of an explanation that goes in behind. And even when you do hear people say, I know I shouldn't, but what are they really doing when they phrase anything in that form? I know I shouldn't, but what follows the but? Yeah, I'm going to do it anyway. And the explanation why. You know, and so in the end, they're still saying, I think I'm doing right, and here is my reason. And so in chapter 16 and verse 2, everybody feels that way. We know everybody feels that way. But the Lord knows, is what it's saying. The Lord weighs the motives, is the New American Standard in the text. Spirits is what it literally says. Well, we just seen a verse where in God's omniscience, He knows Sheol, He knows Abaddon, He knows your heart. He therefore knows your motives. He knows what it is that is actually really, truly moving you to think and speak and act the way that you do. Now, you should raise your hand and stop me, but as we are coming down to the end here, I am moving a little bit faster maybe than I normally would. These are pretty self-evident anyway. And so let's go to chapter 20 now. And look at verse 27. Chapter 20, verse 27. The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. Under a different topic, we'd already touched on that one, so I put it on the board here. You'll remember we talked about it. I'm not going to do it again. But if you're making a list or taking notes about passages that deal with God's all-seeing and all-knowing nature, you'd want to put this one in that category too. And then the last of these, only four, is chapter 21 and verse 2. Every man's way is right in his own eyes, but the Lord what? Weighs the heart. That's exactly, you know, very slightly different, but essentially exactly the same as chapter 16:10. So once again, I just put them on the board for you there. You can collect those, make your notes, and off we go into a different topic. Now this topic is going to be much larger. You can always tell by whether I have only one column or two, how big the typeset is there. But we have many more verses that speak of the human heart, sometimes even God's heart, than we'll be looking at here tonight. Because, in fact, there's about twice as many as you're going to see here tonight. But in quite a number of different categories, we'd already seen this word heart employed, and we've talked about various aspects of human motivation and what goes on in the secret recesses of our minds. And so this is a separate category, has about half the verses if you're just going to look it up with a concordance. But they deal, I think, more directly, maybe, on the nature of the human heart and give us quite a number of different ideas associated with the use of the heart, what we do with our hearts. So I thought I'd go ahead and put this one, in a sort of standalone deal. First one, chapter 4, verse 23, we certainly have already seen. It was one of our earliest classes, as a matter of fact. But I thought we would touch on this one again. It's so fundamentally important that in verse 23, it impacts everything. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. Now, I mention it again, partly just because that is an awfully powerful statement in the first half of that proverb. Watch over your heart, to begin with, means that you're going to have to be, Johnny on the spot. Make sure that you're alert, you're aware, you're awake, you're paying attention to what is going on in your heart. But then they add that other word there. So watch over your heart was big enough in and of itself, but watch over it diligently. So now, this is like guard duty. This is like being out there, with your M16 slung over your shoulder, pacing back and forth out in front of the ammo dump. I remember guard duty when I was in the service. When you were doing guard duty in certain places, like the motor pool, you didn't pay a whole lot of attention. But we actually had a soldier murdered outside the armory one night. And within another couple of weeks, I was assigned to guard duty outside the armory where the murder had occurred. Now, was I on guard more diligently than the last time?
Yes.
Let me tell you, that was a sleepless night. And I could not say that in all of my guard duty, that was true. Sometimes I didn't make it through the night. I fell asleep more than once, as a matter of fact. But that night, I was watching with diligence. That night, every spooky noise I heard had my full attention. That night, if there was some movement in the bushes because some rabbit was out hunting for a carrot, then I was aware of that rabbit's movement. I'm paying attention. And that's what we need to have with our hearts. Jeremiah will tell us the heart is what? Deceitful. Our very own heart is deceiving us. As a matter of fact, all that rationalizing and excusing, because we always think that we're right, it goes on, is that very thing. Often enough, it's our own heart deceiving us. The human mind is very, very crafty and very, very skillful in coming up with reasons and excuses why we should be allowed to do this, that, or another thing. But, therefore, we need a warning, urgently, watch over your heart with all diligence, not just because in that statement you realize how dangerous the heart is and how important that the watching is, but then he gives you the answer or a further insight at the end, for from it flow what? The springs of life. Springs of life is an expression that is beautiful, it's poetic. It's also really kind of nebulous. It's not like you can go into your Bible and find the expression springs of life and get a noun and verbal definition like it was Webster's dictionary. That it's not a term that appears very often in Scripture. I'm not sure it even appears another time in Scripture. So, it's sort of a catch-all kind of a phrase, but if you're talking about life, are you interested? Ought to be. Certainly should be. And whenever you're talking about a spring, what are you talking about? The source, the flow, where it originates. You're talking about where things begin. And so the springs of life has to do with this heart having an impact on everything. Jordan River has a couple of different sources, that one of which is a spring. It's a tiny little thing. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's any much bigger than that table right there when it first comes bubbling out of the ground. There's other valleys where you get flow coming down out of the hills. You know, it will merge up there. And so there's a couple of different sources of the Jordan River, but one of those is a spring. That water that comes out of that hole in the ground is going to make it all 200 circuitous serpentine miles down to the Dead Sea. You know, ultimately, it's going to travel the whole course. It's going to have impact then on everything. So, you know, tough verse to leave alone. It's so important that everything, brethren, flows from a heart that therefore needs to be very carefully guarded, because as much evil can come from it as good. Now, the next passage, though, is all the way over in chapter 14. And by the way, I'm sure you would not have picked up on this, but we have looked in this book, 31 chapters, at every single verse all the way through chapter 13. Now, I was paying close attention to all the different categories that we were doing, but I was also keeping a tally. And then in between, you know, I would kind of work my way through so that we get every verse up through the end of chapter 13. And then the last 2 weeks, and for this one and the next week, we've been doing, you know, topics like the heart right here, but I've also been making sure that if there were verses that we already talked about, you know, that I'm not going to bring them up again. So we're picking up mostly tonight everything, you know, you'll kind of notice is going to start in chapter 14, you know, and go on from there. So chapter 14 now, and that 10th verse says, "The heart knows its own bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy." And by the way, in my Bible, I circled the verse reference, you know, in the margin of my actual Bible. That's at the verse 10. I drew a circle around it. And then in the margin, I drew a line down in the verse 13, and I circled the 13, and I linked those two. They have similar ideas. So they're not adjoining verses, but look at verse 13. "Even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief." So the entirety of verse 10 and just the first half of verse 13 are really on exactly the same subject, though. Now, look at those three lines. Both lines in verse 10, first line in verse 13. Then somebody show me how sharp you really are. What New Testament verse does that remind you of? And I'll give you only this clue. It starts off with, who among men, fill in the blank now. Can you go to the rest of that verse? Who among men, give me the next word, anybody. Okay? Na, 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 na. Okay, I'll give you the next word. Who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God, that's where you were drawing it from the next verse, the thoughts of God no one knows except the spirit of God. All right, well, what do these two verses just say? The heart knows its own bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy. Brother, you'd be surprised. I know I have, many times throughout many years now, at people who are suffering horrifically, and they come in every time we meet. You greet them at the doors, you know, you have conversations with them before and after our Bible classes, and you never realize that they are going through just terrible trials and sufferings and problems that may be physical or emotional, you know, in every realm of human life. This passage is absolutely, certainly true. The people are also very good at masking what is going on in their lives. First half of verse 13, even in laughter, the heart may be what? The heart may be in pain. Now, I don't believe Saul is criticizing anybody for this. You know, I don't think that either the person who's doing the concealing or the person who's not realizing what the other person's going through are at fault right here. God's not, you know, on anybody's case.
he's just pointing out you really need to be aware of this. And we've touched on it in several different areas before, that you need to be alert and thinking about what you're looking at, because things may not be what they seem. They may not be what they seem. And so there may be people who really could use a hand. They need that hand. And maybe they don't have the courage or strength just to ask for it, or they're embarrassed, you know, for some reason. And so maybe we just need to be more alert to kind of look for the clues. But it's just a fact. And so it's not stated as a criticism, I don't believe. It's just stated as a simple fact of the matter. But he tells us that fact so that we might be aware of it. And obviously, then he wants us to think about that, draw some conclusions from that. The first of which, at least, you know, is that you do need to pay attention when you're talking to people. Care about them. They may not be, you know, what they look, just all happy in that. I couldn't tell you how many times I've been surprised. The first preaching I did was in 1979 for a little congregation way up in northern Washington. We were only about an hour and a half from the Canadian border. And I had a couple there for years and years and years. And they were well into their 70s. And I just been over their house. I couldn't tell you how many times. They were there every time the doors were open. And then one day, I still remember how stunned I was. I believe it was a Wednesday night Bible class. The class ended, and the husband came up, and he said, "Well, Larry, I just want you to know this is the last time we're going to be here. My wife and I are getting a divorce. It's been good. Bye." I never saw the guy again. I never had a clue. So there was all kind of bitterness and unhappiness that had been going on in that marriage, but neither the wife nor the husband had ever revealed it to anybody, had ever sought any kind of help, and both of them had been so successful that the entire church was just fall over dead, you know, amazed. We couldn't imagine this. They'd always seemed to be the perfect picture of marital bliss, you know, and now it's a divorce and they're gone. And so, what are these verses saying? Well, be careful. And then, by the way, to recognize at the end of verse 13, there's a secondary thought, I think, or I don't mean secondary in rank, but another thought. The end of joy may be what? The end of joy may be grief. As you start to meditate on that one then, you know, there's at least this one lesson. Be careful when you get what you wanted. You know, what you're wishing, hoping, and praying for. Be careful even when it seems like things are going just great. Because the end of joy may be grief. So you get some kind of great gift and you just think it's wonderful. It may turn out to be just terrible. Now, I've told you this already, but there's an old story about a man in Texas many years ago, faithful member of the church, couldn't have been any more, you know, effective and useful for the sake of the kingdom. And then lo and behold, once upon a time, there was a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day, he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground, come a bubbling crude oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea. Remember the Krampus? Sure enough, he struck oil, or they did, on his property. It didn't take long at all. The guy fell away completely, and that was the end of it. Well, a lot of singing and dancing going on, you know, and suddenly you find out you're going to be extremely wealthy. And then what? Maybe it's disaster, too. So you keep your wits about you no matter what. It's at least part of the ideas that we are given to understand as we're looking at these verses. Watch that old heart. Things can be problematic. Verse 14, a very different kind of a heart verse. The backslider in heart will have his fill of his own ways, but a good man will be satisfied with his. So God's promises in the book of Proverbs are just legion. So many good things, you know, can come. But also disaster can come. So if you're a backslider, if you find that you're getting weaker, that you're less involved, that you're not doing as well as you used to, if you can clearly see that your interest levels, your growth rate, and what's going on in your life spiritually could best be described as backsliding, well,
you'll get plenty of that. You'll get the fill of your leg. You reap what you sow. That's what you sow, and that's what you get. But a good man will be satisfied with his ways. So again, the implication that backslider's not going to be satisfied, this is going to turn out poorly, and one day he'll know it for sure when it's too late. But if you keep your wits about you and you guard that heart and you're a good man, you'd be satisfied with your ways. Okay, chapter 15. Stop if you need to, but if not, chapter 15, verse 13. A joyful heart makes a cheerful face. Literally, it just says a good face, but I think that really is a better way to translate it. But when the heart is sad, the spirit is broken. Now you might think, well, yeah, and obviously. But again, even when something on the surface in Proverbs, and let me say Solomon's depth of wisdom, you know, looks like it's just obvious, and that's all there is to it, food for thought. The joyful heart will certainly change your visage. If you have a joyful heart, most often, people will recognize it. They see it in the body language. They'll understand. What are you so happy about? You know, you see them buzzing. It shows. But when the heart is sad, the spirit is what? The spirit is broken. Now, I would just, again, I'm just offering possibilities and suggesting with every one of them that what I'm offering you is not the only way to understand the verse, that the verse deserves meditation. It deserves that we do some thinking about it. But at least one lesson is all I'm offering on each one, you know, tonight, that I see at least in chapter 15 and verse 13 at the end is this. When the heart is sad, the spirit is broken. When the heart is sad, the spirit is broken. I'm not sure that should just be understood as two ways of saying the same thing. I think at least we ought to consider that what it means is when you choose to be sad, what are you doing to your spirit? You're breaking your spirit. Be careful about that choice. Okay? Now, this I know sounds outlandish every time I suggest it to people, and they say, really, Larry, you did that? You're nuts. They think I'm crazy. Okay? Again, maybe I told you this already, but sadness, brethren, is something that flows out of actual and real circumstances. So if things are going bad in your life, you know, well, great, be sad. You're supposed to be sad. Okay? But can you artificially create that emotion, that feeling in your life? Yeah. And the best way I know is to listen to the blues. What are the blues all about? Yeah. Or country music, of course. You've heard all the jokes. Now, I like both of these forms of music. I really do. But the reason people laugh at me is because about 20 or 30 years ago, I decided I was going to go through my music collection and stop listening to the vast majority of the songs that were just sad songs. And if you go through my iPhone, you're going to discover there's over 3,000 songs there. And there's not probably 1% of them that have anything to do with an unhappy marriage, you know, a teenage breakup, you know, 1,000 other things that people write about. And these songs are very powerful and they're very beautiful, you know, all that. But I decided a long time ago, I don't need to be sad. I also really don't need what, according to the last part of that verse? A broken spirit. Brethren, are you more or less energetic when you're sad? Always less energetic. If your spirit is broken, which sounds to me like something worse that will follow if this progression continues, if your spirit is broken, will you do more work or less work in the kingdom of God? Will you do more or less for your family? More or less for your employer? More or less for whatever you decided to take up skateboarding late in life?
you're probably going to, you know, not succeed at this. If you have a broken spirit and a sad heart, what does it do to your energy levels? It sucks them dry, doesn't it?
Got a big thumbs down back there in the back.
just drains you dry. And so at least I give you to think about 15:13, because some of the sadness that we have in this life, we choose to bring upon ourselves. How many movies are described in terms of how many Kleenex you need? Now, brother, a very emotional movie like that might have great lessons, and you might learn a lot from it, and I watch sad movies. But as a rule, I don't watch zombie movies. I don't watch war movies. I don't watch breakup movies. I don't watch doctor movies. I just don't watch that stuff in my life. Like, avoid it, because probably in your life, there'll be plenty enough of that that's going to come your way. You're not asking for it. Okay? So all I say is, the heart is a very powerful, dangerous, complex device that God's bestowed upon us. And out of it flow the springs of life. So to the extent that you have choices, I'm recommending that you pick happy, upbeat stuff. Banjos over violins. Okay, Rachel.
Well, I think it can also mean that even when truly bad things are happening to you and you're going through tremendous sadness, that you don't stay in it. Because I've seen people in my life that will face the same circumstance and equally sad about the things, but when our joy is in God, then
absolutely. Now, and again, I'm kind of venturing out here because this is maybe even in the realm of speculation. But, you know, in the Old Testament, how long was the period of mourning that the Jews practiced when somebody died? It was 30 days. And there was this set understanding. You mourn for how long? 30 days. And then what? You get up and you get back into life. Now, a psychologist will tell us today, after especially take the loss of a mate or a child or something like that, even the loss of a job, it typically, they say, takes a year to really get over it. And I don't think these two statements are at war with each other at all. I'm not saying the psychologist is wrong and God is right or vice versa. I'm just saying that there was an understanding in the Old Testament that after 30 days, you put off your mourning. Now, I think you might have to be working on that for the next 11 months, but you're allowed, if you will, and it's a poor choice of words, but it gets the job done, you're allowed to wallow in your grief. For how long? 30 days. Now, how many know who Garrison Keillor is? Lake Wobegon. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Lake Wobegon, you know, great storyteller, but also a great humorist. And he had a bit one time, one of his monologues, I just thought it was hysterically funny. And he said, you know, you hear all the time people say, don't weep for me when I die. I want you to rejoice. I've gone to a better place and all that. And he said, not me. He said, boy, I want you guys to just throw fits. I just want you to weep and wail. And be so sad and never ready to make a pair with it. And of course, what he did was very artful and very, very, very funny. But at the same time, you know, really, I think you ought to. And by the way, the Jewish system had what kind of mourners? Professionals or amateurs? Professionals. And what would you do when somebody died?
Hire
mourners. We didn't watch the show. Critical. It was terrible. But what were they doing? They were getting over it by getting on with it. So when my wife dies, if I outlive her, look for this. I'm going to be wrecked. It's going to be horrific. No man has been happier with his mate than I have been. We've been together a long time. I'd have to figure it out. if she dies and I outlive her, I'm going to be useless for a long time. Maybe 2-3 years. But I'm planning to let myself go and just be a ruin for the first 30 days. So when she dies, if I outlive her and I'm still here, look for this. I'm going to weep in your presence, and I'm not even going to try not to. I think it's healthy. I think it's good. I think it's wholesome. I think the scriptures give us, you know, an insight in how valuable that it is. But I'm going to be also looking at my calendar. And when the 30th day is done, you know what I'm planning to do? I'm planning to say, I know I am still wrecked. And that sense of loss is never going away, and I'm going to be a different man from now on. But my 30 days is up. Now it is time for me to start rebuilding a new life. Now it is time for me to get up and get over it. Now it is time to consciously be saying, I've got to get beyond this. I can't spend the rest of my life wallowing in the energy-depleting misery of sadness. Okay? It's a powerful thing. Yes?
I have a question. Back on the second half of 14:14.
Okay?
How can I be humble and be satisfied with myself?
Oh, both the Old Testament and the New, I think, teach simply that we judge, fill in the blank, a what judgment? Judge a righteous judgment. That principle can be applied in a lot of different ways. You know, let no man think more highly of himself than what? Than he ought to. Okay? But brethren, should any man think less of himself than he ought to? No. That's not a righteous judgment. That's not fair. That's not right. It might be hypocritical. But at least it's not correct. Even if it's honest, it's not correct. Everybody has talent. Everybody has value. Everybody is contributing. Everybody in this congregation matters. Everybody has a role to play, something to offer. Now, if you start programming yourself all the time about how you're nothing and I don't mean contribute, I'm bump on a log, you know, and all that kind of stuff, what are you doing? You're breaking your own spirit. That's a form of sadness. You're programming yourself for what? Failure. We call that a self-fulfilling prophecy. You'll reap what you sow. What are you sowing? All kinds of negativity. So you don't think more than you should. You don't think less than you should. Okay? Only Jerry Bassett might have a bigger vocabulary than I do. I've spent a lifetime working at it. Most of you probably haven't. But I have. I just know that about myself. I also know that my children have vocabularies that blow your mind. Because we worked on them together all of our lives. We just thought more words were better and the Reader's Digest was helping. Okay? So I tell you, I have way more words than most people do. Was this making me arrogant? Or is it just a fact? Well, it's just a fact. I'm not better on words. I'm just saying, there it is. I'm also shorter than most of you. So what? Jimmy or Saber or who is her? Saber, you next?
Yeah, I think so. When you're speaking of the broken spirit and sadness, if the sadness is deep enough, your heart physically is broken, and it hurts worse than you can express.
Amen.
You have a very sad face, and it might be longer than a month.
Absolutely, that's the case. I'm not saying you can turn it off like a faucet, you know, on a 31-day month. You can't. But also, you just need to have the conscious awareness. I can deal with this. God wants me to. And I don't want to be self-destructive. So, now's the time for me to start working the problem. It's not the time that it's over, you know, at the end of it. It's just now the time. I need to start working on the problem. Then we allow each other however much time that you really need. Now, brother, medical science has talked about what happens physically on the heart to people, you know, who have high stress and all the rest of that. And literally, you know, it's killing them. It's a very, very real fact.
Okay, so enough on that. I get carried away on all these and, you know, got to go. So chapter 15, verse 15. All the days of the afflicted are bad. Well, that's what we've just been talking about. You're not lying to yourself. You're not saying this is great. It's not. It's bad. But a cheerful heart has a continual feast. Excuse me. A cheerful heart, literally the word is good heart, a good heart has a continual feast. Well, he's already just told us that even in pain, you can have, you know, a smile. We have a certain amount of control, all the varying degrees among us. Somebody in the room has the least amount of talent at it. Somebody else has the most. But we all get to work with it. We all get to have some power and influence in this deal. So in 15:15, all the days of the afflicted are bad. If you've got a cancer that lasts for 6 years, you don't go 30 days and then say, I'm over it. They're bad days for 6 years. Okay, but a cheerful heart has a continual feast. So what are you trying to do in the midst of all of that? You're still trying to be cheerful. Many years ago, I decided my favorite doctor had written an article. You know, he became my favorite doctor because of that article. I have no idea who the guy was. Never saw him in my life. But he wrote an article about the therapeutic value of laughing. Okay? And what he had seen through many years in his practice. And so, he was prescribing the Three Stooges. I thought that was ridiculous. I hate the Three Stooges. I don't think anything funny about those guys. I couldn't get into that form of humor, you know. But I'll take a comedy over a drama any day. Okay? And believe the scriptures will teach, as they do here, even modern science would teach, that to the extent that you can, you should try to get over the problems of life, the sadnesses and afflictions and all the grief that will assail you in life, by choosing to try and balance it and get up and get over it, you know, in time. So, when it's bad, it's bad. Don't lie to yourself. Don't ignore it. But then what? Put on a happy face. Get up and get going. Mike?
Me and my family feel like they always feel oppressed. And I got to say that, I mean, it's not just circumstantial that their days are wretched. I mean, his days are wretched all the time, even though he has a beautiful wife. He has three beautiful children. I mean, he just keeps blessing after blessing after blessing. And, but to him, everything, he doesn't have to go on at all.
Always sees the downside of everything, aren't you? Okay, we've all seen it. You know, we've all seen it. We've all probably chosen it to a certain extent, too, you know. Some of the Proverbs are just here to say, well, hey, okay, this is how the human mind works. This is how your heart works. This is how things are. So now here's advice on trying to, you know, get past these kinds of problems. So cheerful heart has a continual feast. And I went to see Becky Smith, Don and I did, last Saturday. Went to see Becky Smith. You know, poor Ebony, now she had to leave, catch the bus, I guess, you know. But, went to see Becky just on Saturday. Okay? So we go into the hospital. When we came out of the hospital after spending about 25 or 30 minutes with Becky, did we feel better or worse? She just lifted our spirits up to the rafters. It was just awesome talking to her. It was amazing. Yeah, every time I've seen her, it's just been amazing. And she's talking about how her life is going downhill. Her strength is failing. You know, this is life. This is the way it works. She knows. She's not going to rise up some morning suddenly, you know, and say, oh, I got to go quit the Sears catalog and buy me a trampoline, you know, because I need to get back on in shape. It's not going to happen. But her spirit, she chooses to be what? Just so ebullient, just so happy. And you go in there and you just come out and she's telling all these stories about her childhood and, you know, and all the things that she's experienced. And it was just such a laugh. We came out grinning, Don and I both. Just, wow, that was fun. You know? So here we go to console and to condole. And what happens? we're all charged. Oh, wow, we're talking to Becky. it's choice. You know, now her life is hard. It really is. She's got tough circumstances, but she's never known I'm talking to her. Okay, chapter 15, verse 30. Last one, I think, in chapter 15. Bright eyes gladden the heart. Good news puts what? Fat on the bones. Fat on the bones. Now, brother, very often, you know, I've been asked, or people have just mentioned in a class or something like that, I don't know what to do when I visit somebody in a convalescent home. I don't know what to do when I go to their house, and I know the hospice is already there. I don't know what to do, you know, in these kinds of circumstances. I just don't know what to do. Brother, that verse just told you what to do. What did that verse tell you to do? Before you go, what should you be doing? Making you a big, long list of what? Good news. Find something to talk about that's happy. Talk to this person about your grandkids. Can they ever do wrong? Are they ever anything but just so funny? My oldest boy, now 34 years old, when he was just about 2 years old, maybe even less than that, you know, he was just starting to walk around real good. And I don't even know how that started, but we would say, do the washing machine, and he'd go. Can you go into somebody's hospital and say, you know, my grandchild just did the washing machine. This is what it looked like. What are they going to do? Order you out of the room?
Probably.
After my performance, no doubt. You bring good news. This is what you try to do. If you walk in there all sad and worried, I don't know what to do. You know, you go in there, then what? You come out the way you went in. What's going to happen? Find happy things to tell about. Go up on the net and find you a good joke. Preferably not a blonde joke. Find you a good joke. Share a good one. Do something because of this verse. Bright eyes gladden the heart. And I think that works not only for your heart, but for whoever you're talking to. Good news puts fat on the bones. There's always good news, brethren. There is always good news. Get you some and take it on in. 16:21. The wise in heart will be called discerning. And sweetness of speech increases what? Increases persuasiveness. Now, if I get to it, I think we'll see another verse here. It might even be the next one. I forget. It says almost exactly the same thing. Now, I want to announce something tonight. Okay? Nothing's formalized, finalized, may never happen, you know, and all the rest of that. But you've been hearing how for 2.5 years I study every Monday night for 90 minutes with a Seventh-day Adventist preacher in Eastern Washington. Okay? Well, I very formally challenged him, just asked him, there wasn't anything antagonistic about it, to meet me in a public debate after I asked the elders how they felt about it. And he said, sure, I'd love to do it. So, if everything goes well, we're going to try to have a debate between me and a Seventh-day Adventist preacher sometime in the winter, maybe. So we both have time, you know, to prepare. You're going to meet a really nice guy, a fine, moral, upright guy. You know, and a really great guy. His name is Kent Knight. But he's a Seventh-day Adventist, so he's not going to heaven, I don't think. And we're going to try, we hope, to get at least 200 people to come from here and the surrounding congregations and community, and, you know, have a debate on something. We don't even know what yet. You know, we got enough differences, you know, we can work on that. Now, why do you suppose I bring it all up in the light of that verse? Yeah, well, that it is, and that's right, but that's the preceding verse. The one I'm looking at now is 16:21. What are we going to want to accomplish right here? Look at the last part. What is the purpose of the debate? Oh, it's to demolish the other guy and prove he's an idiot.
How
so hard? No, you put him down, right? Prove you're a smarter. What's the matter with you people? That's what I'm in it for.
No, of course not. Well, if you do it right, you're there for the purpose of what's the last word in the verse? Persuasion. Some way to go about that is to mock the guy and show him up and put him down and try to just, you know, ruin his day, right? Wouldn't that be the way most people do debates? Yeah. Then how effective are they usually as a direct result? The bat's next door to useless. Okay? But this guy and I have been together for 2.5 years, and I really like him. I really love him. This is not going to be like any debate you ever saw, I guarantee it. Two really good friends are going to get together and discuss Seventh Day Adventism. Right? He's about 5 years, 6, 7 years older than I am. He's a preacher longer than I have. So we're going to get up. And I think you're going to see two guys really behave because they like each other. It's not going to be like anything you ever saw. And I'm going to very consciously view about that business because according to this verse, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to persuade, not slam and mock and upset and anger and all the rest. I'm not into that. So it's going to be a very different kind of a deal. Linda.
I was just wondering, I remember when I was young.
A little louder, Linda. I can't hear a thing. Tell what I mean. She can interpret
it.
There's two reasons, I think, brethren, very valid reasons why debating is just almost non-existent in our time. Two very different and really powerful reasons why debating is hardly ever done anymore. The first one is because preachers from the Church of Christ were so much more powerful in their argumentation that the other people wouldn't do it anymore. I went all the way down to the San Francisco area back in the late 90s, and I videotaped a debate between a Baptist and Don Wilson, whom a lot of you may know. 4 days, about 4 hours a day, as I recall, in a morning session, you know, and an evening session. And, you know, it was amazing, that whole debate. But I went down there to videotape it so that a record could be made, and I would be able to sell those tapes to whoever wanted to have a copy. The night that debate was over, I had a long line back in the building. People wanted to have copies of that debate. They wanted to study that material. It was very interesting to me. Every single one of them was a member of the Church of Christ, and not one Baptist wanted that material. You know why? Because their guy was just proven wrong every 5 minutes in every argument he set up. Don just destroyed the guy. It was very obvious to everybody, the Baptist chief among them. They never wanted to see that. No one did, because they lost. They didn't have the truth. Okay? But there's another reason why debate fell out of favor, and Don Wilson's not guilty of this at all, but the other reason is a lot of preachers among us are rude and crude and mean and domineering and angry, and they're just out of line. Just out of line. The first debate I ever saw as a very young Christian was between a member of the church that you and I are a part of and a Pentecostal preacher. I will never forget the last night of that debate. Throughout the whole week, the Christian had unequivocally proven that the doctrine of this Pentecostal was absolutely not Bible doctrine. It was so skillful, it was just mind-boggling. And he was so mean that Pentecostal preacher had the last speech of the whole thing. His was the last speech. And when they called for him to do his last speech of the entire 4 or 5 night deal, whatever it was, he stood up in his pew, turned his back on that congregation, and walked out the back door. Wouldn't even speak to him. I jumped out of my seat and ran down the aisle out in the parking lot because I was going to apologize to that man for the way he had been treated and begging him to forgive us. And understand that not everybody's like that. I was so ashamed of that man who had the truth. Because he didn't know how to do what with the truth. He didn't know how to handle it. He did not handle it well. It was terribly destructive and counterproductive. And I wouldn't want to debate him myself. I wouldn't want anything to do with the guy. As a matter of fact, on one major doctrinal issue, that guy kept me from the truth for about, I don't know, 2 more years. Because I thought, surely he can't have the truth when he behaves. So, see all that? We're trying to be what? Persuasive.
Can you be persuasive and agreeable at the same time? Can you be persuasive without being haughty and arrogant and condescending? Can you be persuasive without digging and cutting and... Sure you can. Well, the verse says so. It says you are. So let's. More of that, less of the other. Well, there's two reasons I'll fill out a paper, Rachel. You know, and the others, you never see it. You know, now, well, let's fix it. Let's bring debating back into vogue. What do you say? Let's make it popular again. See if we can't turn that around. 1623. In 1623, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds what to his lips? See what I mean? The very next verse is talking about persuasiveness. That's an art that you need to work on and develop. 1722, and I really am going to race now. I'm determined to get through this passage. And this is good because really this is all I need to get through tonight is these next five, I guess it is. 1722. In 1722, a joyful heart is what? That's good medicine. But a broken spirit does what? Yeah, so if you've been listening to the blues and country music and wallowing in all your unhappiness, and then somebody gets up and announces that so-and-so's feeling poorly and would like you to come over and cheer them up, stay home. You're not going to do any good down there. It's going to hurt these people. Stay home if you haven't got something to offer that they don't have. 23:17. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always. And I can pass on this one because we've had this in others like it in a different category. But obviously, companies that may be, you want to be like those guys, you know, don't envy such people. 24:17, another 17, this chapter. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and he turn away his anger from him. Again, we already talked about this one. In fact, at some length, it's one of my personal favorites, and so we've worked this over quite well. But with regard to the heart, do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles. When justice falls upon somebody, your enemy, it's right, it's proper, it's good, we're glad that justice was served. But be careful. Don't let your heart be happy about it. Now you're taking joy in somebody else's suffering. You know, sure, well, and I've told you this already, I'm sure, but I was in Israel when Osama bin Laden got killed. And it bothered us. There's a lot of Muslims in that country. We were just tourists out there. Those buses get blown up every so often in other countries. We sure didn't want one blown up, you know, that we were on in this country now. And so when we were that night after the tour, gone into the hotel and saw those, you know, TV news deals about everybody singing and dancing and getting drunk in the streets because Osama bin Laden was dead, that's the verse I was thinking of. I was just out of line. We should have been much more somber. We should have been much more restrained and controlled as a people. I'm not accusing you of this, you know, but a bunch of 20-somethings going out getting rocking drunk and partying because Osama bin Laden, you know, has been killed is inappropriate, brethren. And it's pretty frightening, the last part of that verse. What does that say? Mike is saying, your turns are coming, and maybe now sooner. And there's historical Old Testament evidence to that effect, too, which we won't get into tonight. Two more verses and two more minutes. It's just perfect. 25:20. Like one who takes off a garment on a cold day, or like vinegar on soda, is he who sings songs to a troubled heart. Does this teach the opposite about what I've been suggesting would be proper comportment in a hospital? Does it teach the opposite? Well, I don't think the opposite, but it certainly teaches some caution, too. You don't want to take somebody's garment off on a cold day. What happens when you put vinegar and soda together? Yeah, you get the old volcano effect. Okay, so you want to be careful right here. Someone to you sings songs to a troubled heart. Really, I think what he's saying is that you want to be carefully judging, gauging the circumstances. Let your words be with grace, season with salt, so we know how to answer
every man. And so you're going to want to do something that is appropriate. Okay? Now, he that greeteth his neighbor with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, when the proverb began, it shall be reckoned as a what to him?
Curse.
A curse to him. Okay? So, you go down to a hospital where somebody's in immense kinds of pain and suffering, and you throw that door open and you start singing, you know, Joy of the World. What's going to happen? You're probably going to rise right up out of that bed in full strength and healing so they can throw you out the window. You ever heard the word defenestration? You know what that word means? Defenestration. Raise your hand if you know what that means. One of my all-time favorite words. It means throw somebody out the window. There's a whole word for that. It's called defenestration. Brethren, you don't want to heal people because you're so unhappy with it. So you're careful about what you're doing. Sometimes more appropriate than others. You got to know these people. You know, think about what you're doing here. There's an extreme on either end. Last one is 27:19. Wrap this all up. As in water, face reflects face. So the heart of man does what? Reflects the man. Okay? That heart is what you really are. That heart also allows you to see yourself. So when you're thinking about who you are, what you believe, what you're committed to, what you love, you see, your heart is telling you something about yourself, your inner self, your spiritual self, even as when you look down in the water, it reflects your face and see what your outer self looks like. Okay, any comment or questions?